Parataya Patipaditam Bhagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamina Matye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavad Vaishnim.
And this fourth.
Rishir Bhir Bahudha Gitam Rishir Bhir Bahudha Gitam Chando Bhir Vividaif Pratak Chando Bhir Vividaif Pratak Brahmasutra Padais Jaiva Brahmasutra Padais Jaiva Etumad Bhir Vinishtitaihi Etumad Bhir Vinishtitaihi Rishibhi Bahudha Gitam Chando Chando Bhi Vividaihi Pratak Brahma Sutra Padaihi Cha Eva Hetumad Bhi Vinishchitaihi. Okay. Here, after Bhagavan having defined the Kshetra and the Kshetrajna, he says now, by all of the rishis are all of the seers, they say in fact when the creation comes into manifestation, the rishis are there, come along with that manifestation, and receive as though from, like as easy as breath from Ishvara, all of the mantras, the Vedic mantras in their mind. So the rishis are the ones who are the authors really, or from whom this revealed knowledge from Bhagavan comes through them. And so in all of the Upanishads, usually whoever is the rishi for that particular Upanishad, and then their lineage will be cited in the Upanishad, and the rishis are also pervasive through the Vedas, because the whole Vedas is considered to be revealed knowledge through the mouths of the rishis that come along with the creation. So he says, and by these rishis, Bahudha, in many ways, Gitam, it is said, actually it means it is sung. All of the mantras are chanted. You know, so Gitam, it's not exactly singing, it's the chanting of the mantras. And Chandobihi, by the chandas, so in many different ways, it is told by the rishis, and also Chandobihi. Chandas are the meters, the Vedic, the meters, the ragas, but the meters using the swaras that the Vedas are chanted in. That's the chandas. The Vedic mantras are called chandas. So by these also, by all of the rishis with their teaching, and by all of the mantras in the Vedas, it says, vividaihi, in many different ways, bahudha, told. By the rishis told in many ways, and also stated in many ways by the Vedic mantras, as what? They're stated separately. And what that means is, pratak means separate. There's a differentiation which is made between the kshetra and the kshetrajna. There's a division, there's a viveka. Pratak means the kshetra is this, the kshetrajna is this. Other words used, when they say by many different ways, it's taught this. This differentiation between the kshetra and the kshetrajna, when it says in many different ways, what are some of the different ways? Kshetra would be like anatma. Kshetrajna, the atma. So differentiation between the atma and the anatma. Differentiation between the kshetrajna, the knower, and the kshetram, the field. The atma, the self, and the anatma, the not-self. So atma, anatma. Satyam, mitya. So the kshetrajna is satyam, the kshetra is mitya. So in all of these ways, this viveka is being taught. This viveka, this discrimination between the kshetra and the kshetrajna, this division is being revealed. So he says more, It says it's being revealed how, you know, by the rishis and by the Vedas. Brahma Sutra Padaihi Chaeva. By the rishis and by the chandas, by the Vedas, who are using Pada's words. Pada is a word, but a word is something which reveals something. Right? A word is what makes something known, so a word reveals something. So here it is, by the Padas, by the words, which are sutras. Means sutra here means they point to, sutras which point to, imply the meaning of Brahman. This is because, why they say this Brahma Sutra, we've learned the Brahma Sutras, right? And we know of the Brahma Sutras, but here it's used a little bit differently, where these, not exactly differently, but in this, like in this compound, it's a little different. Words which indicate, those words which indicate the meaning, the nature of Brahman. And why they say that is because in the world, all the words that we use always have for their object something that can be objectified, something that exists within duality. We don't have, an immediate meaning for the word Brahman. And then when you say the word Brahman, it doesn't have anything to land on. There's nothing in the dual world which Brahman can land on. Like if I say chair, you know, or table, or even if I say sky, or even if I say consciousness or existence, the immediate meaning of a word like consciousness or existence, consciousness means I'm conscious, I'm not unconscious, or I'm conscious of something, you know. I am there, you should have consciousness of that. You should be conscious of that. These words are always, when I use the word conscious or consciousness, it always has, let's have some consciousness around this. It means let's be aware of this. It always has a dual meaning. It's always related to being conscious of something or having consciousness of something. Or awareness. Let's have awareness. Let's have some awareness around this. Let's be aware of that. Right? Let's be conscious of that. I'm a conscious person. You know, all of that is how we use the word. Consciousness, conscious, awareness, aware, you know. Existence. We can say, yeah, all of these things have existence. This exists, this exists, this exists. Everything that we experience exists. But when I say that, the existence is a marker of the thing that I'm experiencing. Because I'm experiencing it, it exists. I give it that status, right? If I experience it, it exists. If I can't experience it, then it doesn't exist. But the existence, these words are only related to the objects that I'm perceiving. I don't think of existence itself as a noun, or this, that there is such a thing as existence. There is such a thing as consciousness that is independent of any type of objectification, of any type of duality. There is an existence which is in and of itself, being which exists in and of itself, not something which just as a marker or a relation, a way of denoting something that is here, that is present. And so when we're talking about Brahman or the Atma, which is Brahman, we can't use words in a normal way. Right? We have to use words as lakshanas, means words which are pointing to something which itself is not objectifiable as an object. And the only reason that can work is because consciousness is consciousness and it is me, right? The word that we're talking about, consciousness or existence or ananda or ananta, means limitless. These words that we use to denote Brahman, to denote the nature of yourself, those words have to be used as part of a teaching methodology that makes the word able to point to the one who is self-evident, but not objectifiable. In fact, if you, at the bottom line of you, was objectifiable, then what is the nature of the one objectifying it? Right? It has to stop. Is consciousness aware of consciousness, aware of consciousness, aware of consciousness, aware of consciousness? That's not how it is. Right? That would be an infinite regress, and there's no such experience of consciousness aware of consciousness. There is the experience of consciousness, the self-evident nature of myself, which is not being objectified by your sense organs or by your mind. Right? It's because of the conscious being that you are that the mind is known, that the sense organs are known, that the world is known, but consciousness itself is not objectifiable. So how is this going to be taught? So the Upanishads themselves are a teaching methodology for this. So that's why they say, by the rishis, by the Upanishads, by the chandas, by the Upanishads, I'm saying taking the Upanishads from the Vedas because the Upanishads are what focus on this particular thing. Right? So by the rishis, by the rishis and the guru-sishya relationship that is handed down really from Ishwara through the rishis, through the guru-sishya parampara, teacher-student parampara. So by these rishis and by the teachers in so many ways, this differentiation between the Atma and Atma, between what is the self and not self, what is Satyam, what is Mithya, what is the Kshetra-jna and what is the Kshetra, this Viveka, this differentiation is made in many ways by words which are indicators, sutras, being used to as lakshanas to indicate, to unfold the nature of Brahman. And these words that are used in the form of the Vedic mantras, the Upanishads, Hetu mad bihi. They are filled with logic also. It's not, the Upanishads just don't say, you are Brahman, go in peace. No. You are Brahman, the conscious being that you are is Brahman. That's it. No. The Upanishads give so much logic as part of their teaching methodology to take the mind of the student step by step by step to that recognition. So these words which unfold the nature of Brahman, are also filled with logic and understanding. Hetu means cause. So hetu mat, they have cause, means they have cause-effect, they have logic. They have a logical progression. Hetu mat bihi. And vinischitaihi, these words which unfold Brahman, the whole nature of reality, the nature of the self, with so much logic, give one this nischita, they become nischitahi. They are filled with clarity. Clarity means freedom, free from doubt. So the Upanishad, the teaching methodology that's been handed down in the Upanishads and taught by the rishis, that teaching itself, the teaching itself is filled with also logical understanding, which can remove all doubt. So vinischitahi means they are filled with clarity and are free. They themselves are free from doubt and remove doubt from the student. Right? The logic, they would say like this: they give the vision, they give the recognition to the student. These words give that they themselves were taught by the rishis, the teachers. They give that recognition through that teaching methodology to the student, along with logic to dispose of any doubts. That's why we say shravana, the teaching methodology is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana is the unfoldment of the Upanishad, but not just that, the unfoldment of the Upanishad, which involves removing any doubts about what the Upanishad is saying. That is Shravana. So it's giving the vision of the Upanishad. This is all held in the Upanishad itself. The vision that the Upanishad has to give, along with the logic that removes any doubts as to what the Upanishad is actually saying. That is Shravana. That's the Vinishchitaihi, this Brahma Sutra Padaihi Vinishchitaihi. But then the Manana. Manana is different than Shravana. The example for Shravana would be if the word Atma is used in this verse, in this shloka, you know, or in this mantra, does the Atma here mean the mind or does it mean the self? It's just an example. Because sometimes you'll find the Atma is used for the mind. It's also used for the body. Just like if I say I, this word I can mean many different things. You know, Right? If I'm walking to the store, I'm talking about the body. I'm thinking about this, I'm talking about the mind. Right? So the Atma, can be used in different ways. In this particular verse, is the Atma being used, you know, as the self, or as the mind, or as the body? What is the context like that? So there's many, many, many things. The whole Brahma Sutras were analyzed, every single word that the Upanishad is using. And so here in the teaching methodology, when the words, the verses are unfolded, it's not just the use of words, it's the unfoldment of those words and removing any doubts about their meaning, so that with Shravana you become very clear on what the vision that the Upanishad is giving, and you see it. But you can also, you have doubts, is that what it's saying really? And then that's where a lot of more Shravana is done, to see what is actually being said. That's all in the realm of Shravana. Manana is different. Manana has to do with, this is what the Upanishad says, but why couldn't it be like this? This is the Upanishad is giving me this vision, I see, but why couldn't there be more than one Atma? The Upanishad is saying there's only one self, and that self is Brahman. And all of this universe is Nitya. Why does it have to be like that? Why can't there be many, many selves? And why does the world have to be Mithya? Why can't it be its own reality? Because the whole Upanishad is saying Satyam Mithya, and you are the self of the whole creation. I understand that's what it says, but why couldn't it be like this? That is Manana. And so all of these are also dealt with in the Upanishad, in the teaching methodology. They're giving you the vision, making you see it. Then your mind can say, why couldn't it be this way? And that has to, that you need that nishchita. Nishchita is that clarity. So all of these words that are used by the rishis and teacher-student sampradaya that comes from the rishis, and the teaching itself, the Upanishads, which are beginningless. The Upanishads are not given some... they're considered, that knowledge of the Upanishadic knowledge is considered to come with the creation. It's considered beginningless within the tradition. You know, academics can come in and say all kinds of things, but I'm saying how the Upanishad holds this knowledge is something that comes with the creation, is something that's handed down from beginningless time. Birth after creation after creation after creation, if the creation is viewed as cyclical. Shravana, so Shravana, Manana, also Nididhyasana, because the self that is being unfolded by the Upanishads and in this teacher-student sampradaya is you. The self is you, the you that is already present. But because of that ajnanam, ignorance on the part of the mind, you see it, but then continuously, habitually, behave as though you're the body, mind, sense, organs. It's habitual. And so to bring the mind back into relationship with what you've recognized at the time of teaching is what is Nididhyasana. It removes this Viparita Bhavana. Now, Viparita Nididhyasana is to remove the Dehatma Buddhi. It means that conviction that the Atma is the body. That's the conviction that you bring to the teaching. You know, is this really true? Is there anybody? Is there a self that is actually not dependent upon the existence of the body, since the body is going to die? Is there a mind that is not one with the changing thoughts? You know, because my orientation is that, but I'm hoping there's something else. That's what all of the Upanishads, that the student brings these questions to the teacher and to the rishi. Please teach me. Is there something about me that's free from dharma, adharma, free from time? Yeah. And so this unfoldment has to take place. And as I see it, but then, like, you know, they use the example of in the swamp, you can pull the reeds in a swamp, you pull the reeds to the side like that, and then you see all the water. But as soon as you take your hands up, the reeds close over. So when this knowledge is taking place, often it's like a swamp. You know, the teacher separates the reeds, you see clearly, and you walk out the door and it closes over, right? That's the stock example they use. So everybody knows exactly. That's why you're all laughing, because we all know. Okay. So the swamp, the reeds are open and they close. but with Nididhyasana and continued Shravana, the mind, the buddhi, starts to stop closing. Right? Because of that clarity. Because the buddhi has seen from too many different angles, you know. So the buddhi becomes strong. You know, it becomes strong in its knowledge. And that habitual way of responding starts to drop off as the buddhi becomes strong. Another similar example that they use for this Nididhyasana and Shravana. How long should I keep doing Shravana? You know, this question, how long should I, you know, when will the Shravana come to an end? He says, well, you just keep doing Shravana until it, you know, and until you don't need it anymore. But one example they use for that is in the Bhagavad Gita, is if you have a big bonfire, you know, and you're outside, say you're in the beach and you build a big bonfire with all kinds of driftwood and everything, huge. And then you have to light the little corner of it, you know, with your match. Okay. Well, that's precarious. That's very precarious to get this thing. You've got to have, you know, lots of maybe, you know, kindling and whatnot and paper and to try to get it to go. And so you light this big, huge bonfire with a little match, and then you have to protect it. Till it find as it starts flaming, you know. But as you're protecting it, and you have to protect it for a while, but there comes a time when the flame is so strong that the wind itself will enliven it, and the bonfire starts, you know, being consumed by the flame. But that's not how it is initially, you know, because initially the ajnanam is so thick, you know, and the way of relating to the world, you know, is, now, I am this body, mind, sense organs, and I need the world to make me happy. That's what we come with. But we, as a mumuksha, we come with also a feeling, a recognition that this isn't working. This is how I'm oriented, but it's not working. And there must be something else. That's why I come. That's why I come to this teaching. So they use all of these examples, but what is the protection for the mind, for you? What is the protection? Well, one is to satsang. You come to class. You keep getting this vision over and over and over. You keep company with people who are like you, who have similar values, They don't have to necessarily be Vedantins. They have to have similar values. You know, that protects you. You know. And then you keep doing Shravana, and then you do Nididhyasana. Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, Katana. Katana means, so Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. Katana is discussing and talking with each other in satsang. So these are the things, you know. And so in this type of a in environment, then one gains this clarity of knowledge. So the teaching means absorption in this teaching until your mind sees it clearly. Until there comes a time, there's a process. One of my what do you call these jet calls?
Sales calls?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Robocalls.
Yeah, robocalls. So in this thing, there's so many things here that pratak is the differentiation between satyam mitya. If you say kshetrajna, kshetra, satyam mitya, if that differentiation is there, then you are the satyam, everything else is the mitya. You are the kshetrajna, everything else is the kshetra, is mitya. That becomes clear. Then the changeless, full, whole, complete being that you are is who you are. And this is all Ishwara. The kshetra is Ishwara. The kshetrajna is Atma, is Brahman. So Brahman, you know, Ishwara. Like that. Brahman, Ishwara. This body, mind, sense organs goes over to Ishwara, the kshetra. You know? When you think of the kshetra, it's this whole creation, which includes this body, which includes the sense organs, which includes the mind, which includes the causal state, ajnanam, all of that is kshetra. So your body is kshetra along with everything else. Your mind is kshetra, along with everything else. It's all Ishwara. And yourself is free. The Atma is free. The Atma is Satyam. And the Atma is Satyam, who is the Kshetrajna, who is Satyam, Kshetrajna, Atma. Okay? So that's the protect. That's what's made so clear by all of the Upanishads and by all of the Rishis, with words that reveal Sutra, Brahma Sutra, these words which reveal the nature of Brahman along with logic, nischitaihi, very clearly, yeah, with great clarity. Okay? So that's a pep talk. That's what Swamiji says. Okay. Let's do the next verse. So now he's going to talk a little bit and reveal the kshetra, exactly what it is. He says, Mahabhutanyahankaraha, Buddhiravyaktamevacha, Indriyani tashaikancha, Indriyani tashaikancha, Panchachandriya gocharaha, Panchachandriya gocharaha, Mahabhutani ahankaraha, Buddhihi avyaktam evacha, Indriyani dasha ekam cha, Pancha cha Indriya gocharaha. He now is going to tell to Arjuna the nature of the kshetra, what it includes. So he starts with Mahabhutani. The kshetra is comprised of these things, the Mahabhutas. The Mahabhutas are all the five subtle elements. So when the creation manifests, comes into manifestation, the first thing that comes into manifestation are the five subtle elements. By subtle elements, they mean those elements that have not gone through this process of panchikarana. Panchikarana means the process of becoming fivefold to make this whole physical world. So the five subtle elements, the Mahabhutas, space, air, fire, water, earth, in their subtle form. Then the ahankara. Here by ahankara, they don't mean the jiva. Ahankara is the ahankara of the five subtle elements. And so what they mean here is Ishwara, Hiranyagarbha. And so to kind of understand this, when the creation comes into manifestation, it is like they don't use this word here, but it's the Mahat Tattva. Swamiji uses this word. When the five subtle elements first come into manifestation, it is like an infinite mind. And why I say that is your mind, if I go through this Panchikarana, which I will be doing in brief now, your mind itself is considered sattva, the five subtle elements. Each one of us has a mind. If I were to say in terms of maya, in the sattva, rajas, and tamas, your mind is made of the five subtle elements. And each of the sense organs, each one is made of one of the five elements. And so each of those five elements that are the sense organs are made of come into the mind, which is sattva, which is made of the five subtle elements. So that's for the jiva. That's your mind, the Mahabhutas, just the five subtle elements, but individual, right? Because jiva. But if I take that's called vyeshti, the vyeshti upadi, the limited upadi, right, of the jiva. The limitless upadi, the collective upadi, or the vyeshti means individual, like the individual upadi, conditioning agent. The total conditioning adjunct is called sameshti, so the sameshti upadi. So that's Ishwara. If I take the total upadi, the total conditioning adjunct, and I look at just the five subtle elements, that is a mind, right? Because your mind is the five subtle elements. This is the infinite mind, the collective, the total. And the total five subtle elements makes a total mind that we can call Ishwara or Hiranyagarbha. we'll call Hiranyagarbha, because Hiranyagarbha is the sukshma, is what we call Ishvara from the standpoint of the infinite mind. And so we say Ahankara because this infinite mind has a sense of I. It's not using Ahankara in terms of Ajnanam, like you have an Ahankara because you take your being, you to be the mind, and if the mind is sad, you are sad. If the mind is happy, you are happy. Or you take you have an Ahankara that takes your being to be the body, so therefore I'm a man or a woman, or I'm subject to illness, and I'm subject to birth and death, and I'm different from you. That's an Ahankara based on ignorance. But Bhagavan, Ishvara, has no ignorance. And so what we mean by Ahankara there is not an ignorant Ahankara, it's that this infinite, the Mahabhutas, the infinite subtle elements reflect consciousness. We reflect consciousness, and so they have a sense of I. So in fact, this whole creation has a sense of me. It is a conscious being. So the Mahabhutas, the five subtle elements, the Ahankara, that Ahankara is identifying with the sattva of the five subtle elements, which gives that sense of me, and that's Hiranyagarbha. The buddhi is the mahatattva. When we look at the five subtle elements, the sattva, that's the infinite buddhi, which gives this sense of I. Okay, so the mahatattva, the buddhi, we're talking on a total level. And the avyakta, but what we mean by avyakta, is the causal condition. Avyakta is the maya in causal condition. What we say is, remember the creation, how the Upanishads or the Shruti unfolds the creation is that it is cyclical. It comes into manifestation, is sustained, and it goes into unmanifest, from beginningless time. Okay? So the unmanifest, when the creation is in unmanifest condition, we say it is in causal condition. In the same way as when you as a jiva go into deep sleep, all of your knowledge, your faculties, are in causal condition. Right? They're not gone. They're just not operational. They're in their unmanifest condition. In time of deep sleep, all of your knowledge is in unmanifest condition. So for Ishvara, when all of Ishvara's knowledge is in unmanifest condition, the whole creation is unmanifest condition. Right? The creation is not, there is no physical creation from the standpoint of Ishvara. There is, let me put it like this, there is physical stula, the stula sharira, the sameshti, the total stula sharira, and sukshma sharira from the standpoint of each other, right? But not from the standpoint of maya. In this sense, if I ask you to have an imagination, let's say you have an imagination, and what you're seeing in the imagination, and you have people running around in that imagination who all have a mind and sense organs, okay? Those people are looking at the creation through their sense organs. The people in your imagination are experiencing the world through their sense organs. The world they experience through their sense organs is what we call physical or gross. Do you understand what I mean? The world that we experience, that's what we label it. Like here, right now, I'm talking about this world as physical, because it's the world that I experience through my sense organs. That gives it the name physical, the physical world, the stula sharira. My mind, which uses my sense organs and can imagine and has all of these other capacities, we call that as subtle, right? And the sense organs, the sense organs that are used to give the vrittis, we call those subtle, the power of sight, not the physical sense organs. That's subtle. But from the standpoint of the imagination itself, the whole thing, right, is like a manifestation of knowledge. The imagination is a manifestation of your knowledge. You see that? So for Ishvara, the whole creation is a manifestation of knowledge. And that within that manifestation of knowledge, there is subtle and gross from within the perspective for those who are within the creation. You know, and so we can say from this infinite imagination, you know, that if we're looking at Hiranyagarbha, we're looking at the mind aspect of it. If we're looking at the physical world, we're calling that Virat. But it's actually just one manifestation of infinite knowledge. You have the exact capacity yourself, you know, when you have an imagination or when you have a dream. When you talk about just the dream that you're having, the subtle and gross, it's different. It's not like the gross is gross. The gross is the projection of Maya, right? Maya is mitya. Maya is mitya. It doesn't have any real being other than consciousness. So if you say something is gross, that's only in reference to your sense organs, because actually all that is there is consciousness. You know? Like the clay pot. The pot is mitya. There's really nothing there but clay. So here, all of this, there's a subtle level and a gross level and a subtle level from within it, you know, as you define it within kind of the Maya. But really, it's only Maya, which is mitya, which has no being at all apart from consciousness. So what we call matter, physical matter, is nothing but consciousness. Subtle matter is nothing but consciousness. Really, there is no matter, there is only consciousness. And so this infinite creation is a projection of Maya, which has no being apart from consciousness. So people, when they think, well, what is the brain and all of this? You know, the brain is consciousness. You know, the liver is consciousness. The rug is consciousness. The chair is consciousness. There is nothing but consciousness. You know, so if we want to get into, you know, the brain being the self, then we have to get into matter. See, once you get into the brain and all of this and the sense organs and the, you know, the heart and the liver and all of these type of things, isn't this what producing consciousness? Then we have to go and dissect matter. We have to go in and dissect matter. And what we find out is that there is no matter. Matter doesn't exist. Matter is just namas. Names within names within names within names within names. You can never find any matter. The more you analyze matter, you get into the infinite regress of infinitely going names within names within names within names. So that's another step that you have to end up doing. Anyway, so here. Mahabhutani, what they mean, the five subtle elements, the infinite projection of the five subtle elements. Dhyanahankara is the eye sense that these five subtle elements have. The buddhi is the sattva, the infinite mind of the five subtle elements. The avyakta is the causal condition of them that allows the universe to come into manifestation and go out of manifestation from beginningless time. Once that manifestation is there, then from the jiva, we have the indriyas, the indriyani. The indriyani are the five sense organs and the five organs of action. So he says, dasha indriyani, the 10 organs, the five sense organs, and the five organs of action. Then he says, and ekam, ekam cha, and the one, and the one mind. So there's five sense organs, there's five organs of action, and then there's the manas, the antakarna. The antakarna has four parts, the chitta, the memory, the buddhi, the intellect, the ahankara, the eye notion, the manas, the fluctuating mind. So that makes 19 components. This makes the jiva. Right, so he's left out the prana and the pancha, he's left out the prana. So he says the five indriyas, the five indriyas, the 10 indriyas. So that's the five sense organs, the five organs of action, the ekam, the mind, and pancha cha indriya gocharaha, and the five objects of the sense organs. Indriya gocharaha means gochara means those were that which is perceived by the indriyas. So those are the five sense objects. So he's just sweeping through, trying to tell what is the kshetra. All of this, from avyakta to all of Hiranyagarbha to virat to everything about the jiva, all of this is the kshetra. But he goes on. We usually do this five and six together, so let's do this one. He says, Icha dvesha sukham dukham, Icha dvesha sukham dukham, Sangatas chetana dhritihi, Sangatas chetana dhritihi, Etat kshetram samasena, Etat kshetram samasena, Savikaram udahritam, Savikaram udahritam, Icha dvesha sukham dukham sanghataha chetana dhritihi etat kshetram samasena savikaram udahritam. He says, just in case you think your desires or something like that may not be the kshetra, he says, no, icha. Your desires, those are kshetra. Dveshaha, your hatred, your dislike, all of these emotions, kshetra. These are all objectified. These are all experiences that are coming and going. Right? They're things that you're aware of. They're the kshetra. So your desire, your dvesha, your dislike, your hatred, sukha and dukkha, your pleasurable experiences, your sorrow, your pleasure and your sorrow, sukha and dukkha, your happiness and your pain, pleasure and pain, these are all kshetra. Then he says also, sanghataha, this whole body, mind, sense organs. The body, the mind, the sense organs, this whole complex, sanghataha. This complex, body, mind, sense organs complex, with all of your organs of action, this complex here, kshetra. Chetana. Chetana means all of your cognitions, you know? All of the cognitions, like I know this and I know that, and this thought and this thought, this experience, all of your mental cognitions, chetana, kshetra, dhritihi, all of your fortitude and your strength and your courage, your dhriti, and all of the strong things about the buddhi, kshetra. It says, etat kshetram, all of this is the kshetra, you know? All of your resolve, all of your desires, all of your happy experiences, all of your painful experiences, all of your hatreds, all of your cognitions, and all of your fortitude, all of these things, kshetra. He says, etat kshetram. Samasena, in brief, he says, and all of this is the kshetra, savikaram, along with all other modifications that they can go through. Savikara means together with all the... Vikara means any modification, any change. So this is the kshetra, along with all of the modifications, all of these things can go through. This, in brief, is to be understood. Samasena means in brief. This, in brief, is to be understood as the kshetra. In other words, from the ajnanam, or from the deep sleep state, to the causal condition of Ishvara, the whole Maya Upadhi and its causal condition, and everything that comes into manifestation without any exception is the kshetra. This kshetra is mitya. Mitya means it's clay pot. It's the pot to the clay. It has no being at all apart from the kshetrajna. And so this kshetra, which includes every experience imaginable that can come into being and go out of being, any experience that exists within duality, that is bound by time, that is kshetra. And now, having said this, he has to go into the kshetra jnana. And it's interesting to goes into the jnanam. How is this viveka going to be known? This discrimination between the kshetra jnana and the kshetra. What is the jnanam for this? And he's going to go now into, which we'll start next week, these very famous qualities, amani tvam, adambi tvam, all of these states of all of these ways of being, values, all of the values of the Antahkarana that make the Antahkarana actually able to understand this. So they're all of the values that, as the Antahkarana enjoys these values, it gains a depth of shanti that allows for it to clear, it becomes a clear window so you can clearly see. And so, you know, the mumukshus, the sannyasis chant these values every day. It's 1, 2, 3, how many verses? 4 or 5 verses. They usually chant this every day, just to bring the mind kind of into, it's like brushing your teeth or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out with, you know, recognition of all of these values so that more and more they become natural to you. So it's really for Antahkarana Shuddhi. But they go through these values here because they bring the mind into a condition of being able to receive this knowledge. And so we watch ourselves mature into all of these values. And so let's stop there.
Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
All of this is Ishvara's projection. When I project with my imagination, I can make like subtle objects in a subtle world.
Right.
But I don't seem to be able to project a gross world, one that's physical.
Well, that's what I was talking about, actually. There is no gross world. The gross world, like you have to be making that distinction from within the world. Like, for instance, if you project a world, whatever it is, say you project a city scene or a meadow or whatever, within that projection, there is subtle and gross, right? There you would call the trees are gross, the trees and the grass and the sky and the sun are physical. The emotions of the characters and the eyes, what they perceive, and their vrittis are subtle. Right, so that distinction takes place within the projection. But if you look from the one who's projecting, it's manifest knowledge. Right, and within the manifest knowledge, you can make the division of subtle and gross, but not from the standpoint of the manifestation of the knowledge. And so you can say that, like, here, now I'm having imagination of a meadow, but the meadow is only subtle, it's only taking place in my mind, compared to this physical world.
That's right.
Right? But from within the imagination, they're subtle and gross. Here, why you can say that is because you're part of Bhagavan's manifest knowledge, right? And so you have this dual order going on, where you see yourself as a physical being within the physical world who has a subtle mind, right? So there's subtle and gross here that you have. But you can't, you're jumping orders of reality. If you look at your own imagination from within here, from here, then the imagination is subtle. and this is physical. But if you look at the imagination from its own standpoint, within it, there's subtle and physical. You understand? Mm-hmm. You're not Ishvara. You're the Ishvara of your imagination. But you're not the Ishvara of this imagination, the jiva. The jiva is the Ishvara of the subjective imagination. But the jiva is not the Ishvara of this imagination. The jiva is a part of this imagination.
Is that why you can say that everything is consciousness, or is there another logic to get to that?
There's another logic for that. Because when you start analyzing the nature of this manifest knowledge, which both subtle or gross, it doesn't make any difference. In the analysis, you discover that there is nothing here other than consciousness, because anything that you say is a thing, what we call a vastu. Anything that you say is a thing is actually just names within names within names. Like we say, this is a lamp, but really, lamp is a name for a bunch of other things. Lamp is a name, and then when I analyze it, there's names within this name. Like we have lamp is a big name that includes this metal rod and the metal base and the screws and the light and the filament and the wire and on and on and on. And as the more you analyze it, the more there are names within names. Like if I say this metal rod and then I go into it, well, it also has black paint and, you know, and then I go into the nature of the metal itself and I have names for all of that.
We can never find it.
Yeah. And that process is like there's an infinite names within names, but you never get to the end of it. And it's impossible to get to the end of it. Because as long as the name itself is taking up space, whatever the name is a name of, is taking up space, that space is divisible. Right? And so if it's divisible, then we have more names.
So what
it proves is that there's nothing here. There's just names here of one substance. And the one substance that is here is not something that can be objectified. Because if it can be objectified, it's divisible. That's one logic. Mm-hmm. Another understanding is that everything that is here, that includes the body, the mind, the sense organs, the perceptions, every experience on every level, is subject to time. And anything that is subject to time is bordered by non-existence. Anything that is subject to change is bordered by non-existence, because it has a prior condition and a posterior condition, which is different than what it is now. Now, if that's so, if everything that you experience is bordered by change, another way of saying it is it's bordered by non-existence. Non-existence doesn't exist and nothing can come from it, you know? And so the more that we go on analyzing the world, what we end up with is that which cannot, which is, because we also, there's never a time that there's not is, being. There is no experience that is free of being. But being can't come into being and go out of being, nor does it ever. Being is the constant. But being is not something, oh, look at the being, you can't objectify it. You can't objectify it because it's free of time, it's free of duality. And so the more you analyze the creation, the more you find out that there is nothing here really except for being, which is consciousness. It's not even consciousness of anything, it's self-evident being. The instant you say self-evident, you bring in consciousness. See, if being can't be self-evident, right, without being consciousness. The self-evident being is consciousness. And that consciousness is me. Because when I say another thing, when I say that consciousness is me, you say, well, how can it be me? Well, because there is nothing else. There is nothing else. Everything else is mithya. And even if I analyze my own situation, we can analyze the whole universe like this, the whole material universe like this, or even this body, mind, sense organs, all, again, names within names within names. What is it? Names within names within names of me, of conscious being. When you meditate, what do? You pull your sense organs and your mind away from anything objectifiable, and what is always left? What is there all the way through that process, changelessly through the whole meditative process? What is there is me. It's just that you're withdrawing the names within names within names, so that they're not experienced, you're just left with your own being. What happens when you wake up from a dream? The dream is so real, you know, because you were existing, you were experiencing the dream from within the dream, or even as the Ishwara of the dream, but that when the dream wakes up, when it goes, what is left is just me. The very me that was there in the dream. The me, it's not a different me, it's the me that was there at the dream. It was the me that was the whole dream, or the me that was identified with the character in the dream. Both are true. I'm both the whole dream and I'm the character in the dream. I'm all the characters in the dream. I might be identified with one of them, or I might be identified with the whole. You know? But when the dream goes away, nothing happens, because what is actually there is changeless.
And what about deep sleep then?
In deep sleep, the only thing with deep sleep is at that time there's no activity going on. There's no display of duality. Right? But so the mind itself is in unmanifest condition. So
but
there's
even that I can know.
You do know. You know why? Because when you do know, the mind is not functioning as a knower when it's in causal condition, but when you wake up from that, then the mind had that deep sleep experience, and you can talk about it. You know what deep sleep is. That's why I can describe it to you, and you said, yeah, that's what happens. Like just simply to be able to say, in deep sleep there's no knower known. There's no universe. There's no commentary. You're just really me without any commentary at all. And it gets rid of the idea of yourself as a knower also. You're not a knower of something. In the people think of consciousness only in terms of consciousness of something, you know?
So that's why Swamiji calls it the lazy man's samadhi?
Yeah. Because he'll say, tongue-in-cheek, really, that, you know, ignorance is very painful, but absolute ignorance is bliss. Because everything just, you know, there's only you. You're there with a mind that is in its subjecta and its causal condition. You know, it's not the same as nirvikalpa samadhi, but it's also, you're freed of all of the pains of duality, you know. That's not being experienced. We say that avyakta, that deep sleep condition, is still dukkha. In the Mandukya Upanishad, the prajna, is still, Gaudapada is talking about that is still dukkha. The waking state, vishwa, is dukkha, taijasa is dukkha, and prajna. All three states are dukkha. And you ask, how is it that prajna, the deep sleep state, is dukkha? Well, because it's the causal condition for the other two. It's just a relief, but it's the causal condition for the other two, and so then it's really the source of dukkha. So it's the big dukkha, in a way. Even though the dukkha is not experienced at that time, still, it's holding it. And in taijasa and vishwa also, there's not dukkha experienced all the time, but their condition is of limitation. It's subject to limitation and change. Right? The taijasa, the dreamer and the waker. And so there's no constancy there.
No. This thing about Ishvara having an ahankara, it's something I don't completely
get
that. Because, well,
that, yeah. There's a different way that word is used differently, that's why.
Okay.
When I said for the jiva, yeah, when we use the word ahankara, it's bound by ignorance. Mm-hmm. So, we say like this, for maya, ajnanam is like is the other side of Maya. So for Ishwara, the Maya is the Maya, you can say, has two properties. One is avarna, one's vikshepa. Avarna means it has the capacity to cover. And vikshepa is the capacity to project. So it can cover the rope and then project the snake. All is like one, but two sides of one coin. Okay. So the jiva is subject to Maya in both avarna, its covering capacity, and vikshepa, its projecting capacity. Right? So covering myself, then I take myself to be the mind. Covering myself, I take myself to be the body. Or externally rope snake, that type of thing. But Ishwara is only, has no avarna, it's all vikshepa. Right? Because total. So there is no lack of knowledge. It's a manifestation of absolute knowledge. And so there's no avarna, there's no covering. And so now for Ishwara, when we use the word ahankara, what we mean is the sense of I, because of the sattva that the upadi, the samishti, the total upadi, enjoys. You know, like, say you're a jivanmukta, you're a jnani.
Mm-hmm.
Your mind, because it is sattva, made of sattva, which reflects consciousness, the five elements, the sattva aspect of the five elements, as long as the mind is there, it will have a sense of I, right, because of the sattva. So the whole infinite Maya Upadi, the five subtle elements, right, the sattva of the five subtle elements, that will have a sense of I. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like if I'm looking in a mirror, even though I know it's a mirror and not me, my reflection will still be there. Okay? And so the sense of self will still be there in the Upadi, but without the Ajnanam.
So when you do it like a contemplation, that sense of being, that's that sense of I, of Ishwara.
But the sense of the I is Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, like when we were doing the meditation, what I was trying to point out in the meditation really is that your presence is not covered by the vrittis. Or by the thought flow. You can have the thought flow can be there without any disturbance to you. It's not like the thought flow comes and then you're gone. The thought flow need not bother you at all. It doesn't cover you. However, the mind, because of its associative thinking, can kind of get lost. It's almost like a delusional state. Where the mind just gets lost and it's off on its own.
So a fugue state.
Like a fugue state, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So it mistakes, the mind mistakes the sense of I for...
To belong to itself.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm saying when you're sitting in meditation or sitting right now at this moment, yourself is self-evident. It doesn't require the mind for it to be its own experience, self-evident being. Right? It doesn't require the mind for that. And now the mind is going on thinking. But the mind's self is that self-evident being. So the mind itself doesn't cover you in any way. But in meditation, what you want your mind to do, instead of just having this thought and that thought and this thought and that thought, is to actually pay some attention, you know, to your own being. So not only is thinking about this and that and this and that, It's recognizing you from its own standpoint. Right?
So for like Ishwara, then, is the ankara something like it, kind of like Brahman knowing its projection as itself, something like that. In other words, Brahman has self-evident awareness. But then there's the Maya projection of Maya.
Is a jnani, is an infinite jnani.
Is known as itself, basically.
Yes, the right. Truth of it is known. There's no
it's sort of like analogous, like if we're sitting in meditation and we're having thoughts, but even if we're having thoughts, still we know that the thoughts are merely a reflection of our own presence.
You know it without even words. Right, once that right. knowledge is, you don't even need words for it. It's just a fact.
Right.
The words were necessary initially to point it out to you. Mm-hmm. But once that ajnanam is being removed, has been removed, then it's just the fact that you don't need to comment on. Mm-hmm. So for Ishvara, it's just a fact. It doesn't require words. There's just no ajnanam there to have it cause it to be mistaken.
And that's the sense of the ahankara.
Yeah, that's the ahankara. That's okay. That the universe has that sense of I. Mm-hmm. Mm. It's also called abhimana. You know, that I-ness, which that me-ness, which the universe enjoys. Well, because there is nothing, the I-ness or me, I use those words to make it more personal, is really all that is here. You know, and so here now, without this dehatma buddhi, where you take your being to actually be this, and then I'm looking through the eyes and all of that, if you can have that viveka, you can see that actually there is no experience at all that isn't pervaded by me. It's the dehatma buddhi that makes you think that this me is just stuck on this body, but actually your whole experience is pervaded by you. Just like if I ask you to think of a meadow, imagine a meadow, that's very easy for you to see, this is totally pervaded by me. Right? If I have an imagination, I can see, this is just me. Do you understand that? Mm-hmm. This isn't any different. The experience is no different. Because vritti, vritti. So just think about, now this is just, think of, in, to break this mindset, think, okay, I'm now having an imagination of this room. Another way, I'm having a vritti of this room. There's no part of it that's not pervaded by me. There's no part of from Ishvara's standpoint, there's no part of the universe that is not me. I am itself, but I am the satyam, it is the mitya. Mm-hmm. Right? But I am itself. That's a self-evident fact. You don't have to say it for it to be known. Like your knowledge, you don't have to walk around saying I'm Brahman, or you don't have to once you have knowledge, you don't have to talk about it. Or you can talk about it also, but you don't have to talk about it for it to be so.
How does that release you from samsara then?
Because yourself is everything you seek. The very wholeness or ananda or well beingness that is your nature is now recognized as your nature. Not something to be achieved or hung on to, or to be achieved or gained or to be protected. You don't need to protect it because it can't change. There's nothing you can do about it. The thing is, as a samsari, we think that we have to, first of all, create situations where I can feel that way, you know, and then protect the situation, you know, from all of the enemies. That try to take it away.
So does that really go away?
It really goes away. But that is what we mean by vairagya. What vairagya is, or the absence of vairagya, is I need this to be this way to be happy. I need this to be this way to be happy. It's all an illusion. You don't need anything to be happy. You know? But what happens is the joke is it's such amazing. And everybody's under the same delusion because it works. Well, it works in a way. Like when you fulfill a desire, you have a moment of all is well with me. You have a moment of desirelessness, and then this is wonderful. And it only lasts for a few seconds, 15 seconds. If even that, you know, you can have this expectancy of this is going to be so good, and so you get kind of a high off of that, and then when you actually get the thing, nothing has happened. Nothing happens. You know? It's amazing. But we're all running around with this delusion, because you do get a moment, you know? You get a moment, but that's all. But the moment that you get is brought about by the mind for a moment. Not wanting anything, because there's a little space between desires. So you get a moment of the mind being having a shanta vritti. But with knowledge, you recognize that the knowledge you're no longer dependent on these shanta vrittis, because you've recognized what is underlying the shanta vritti, The very source of the shanta vritti is my own being. And so I don't need to have any vritti. I don't care what the vritti is, because the self-evident nature of yourself, you can't do anything about it. It's always there. And you're not dependent on the mind anymore. Well, my mind has to be this. I don't really care how my mind is, because I'm fine. And that's what's been differentiated. The self who is fine, no matter what the thought is.
So it doesn't matter what the upadhi is doing, whether it's cheerful or sad or depressed or elated.
Well, I would say like this. The reason for being, in a sense, that's true. It doesn't matter. On the other hand, the reason for the elation or the depression, the things that cause that, go away. Because it's not the things that are causing it, it's your relationship to the things that are making you unhappy. You know? When you've recognized the source of the fullness, and that's not something that anybody can take away from you, and you don't need anything for it, then the mind becomes relaxed. You know? It becomes it's like the problem is solved. In a sense, it's not that the world can throw up all kinds of hardships, but you just deal with that objectively. The problem of your own well-being is solved. And no one can take away that well-being, not even you. You can't take it away from yourself. You can't take it, you know, nobody can take it away from you, and you can't take it away from you either. Nobody can take it. Bhagavan can't take it away. That's even a verse like that. Even Ishwara can't take away the nature of yourself. Because that's Ishwara's nature too. It's not objectifiable to be tampered with or taken away. And your mind can never get away from you. Your mind is mitya. It can never get away from you. Wherever it goes. So nothing can be done. Even though the mind can cause this problem and that problem. For a jnani, like Swamiji, has said, mind can do all kinds of funny things. So what? It doesn't matter. And those funny things, the habitual ajnanam caused problems of the self, of the mind, go away. So the mind enjoys shanti, but that vairagya has to come in time, you know? That's assimilation of your knowledge.
Why did you just say that the mind is mithya? I mean, everything is mithya.
Everything is mithya.
So why did you point out that the mind is mithya?
Because it's never away from you.
Uh-huh.
Right, and but doesn't have any capacity, doesn't have any substance to change you. You are itself. That's what I was meaning. Like the pot is the clay. Whatever the pot does, it's still only the clay. So there's no distance between your mind and you. Yeah. You are the self of the mind, and that self is never changing. And so whatever type of vritti the mind has, it could be a real dukkha vritti. You are still its self. Right? So there's no distance between you and the dukkha vritti. So like that, you can be with yourself. But for ajnani, there's no viveka there. There's no recognition there. There's no relationship between your being and the vrittis that are passing through, or the moods and emotions. There's no relationship because there's no viveka. So all of the focus on the mind is on the quality, the nature of the vritti. If it's a happy vritti, a sad vritti, a tired vritti, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's who you are. Because no viveka. That's why in this first verse that we did, that prithak, all of the rishis, all of the Upanishads are talking about this prithak, the difference between the kshetrajna and the kshetra.
Mm-hmm.
Satya, mithya, atma, anatma. So all of them, in so many different ways, is that to get that viveka. The whole viveka resolves in satyam mitya. There has to be a viveka between satyam mitya. And that's the Advaita also.
So pratak is like...
separate, the viveka.
It's like capital T, the distinction. Is
yeah.
that the way they're...
Yeah, the distinction, the pratak. That the kshetra is pratak from the kshetrajna. There's viveka, there's a differentiation. You have to see that. You know? And then you think, okay, well, there's the Atma over here and the Anatma over here. No, it's Satya Mitya. It's clay pot. This has no being apart from you. You are its very self, and you're changeless, and nothing can escape. Nothing can touch you, and nothing can get away from you either. There's a verse in one of the Upanishads you can send. I think it's Katha. You can send the mind to the moon, and the self is already there. You know, I take a look at the moon, but I'm already there. You can never, you know, get away from your being, and your being is whole and complete. So, and over time, depending on what you bring to this knowledge, the level of, you know, Viveka and Vairagya and all of that, your mind, every one of us brings enough Viveka, Vairagya, all Mumukshutvam, to have any interest in this teaching. So you have whatever, you have enough to be a mumukshu. And to whatever degrees that are lacking there are something that come in time with Shravana. You know? But as you live with this knowledge, your mind more and more just stays home with the wholeness of your being, and from that sthanam, from that place, enjoys the world, lives out your prarabdha, you know, and engages in your life. Engages in your life without fear. Because otherwise we have a lot of fear, because we're trying to get our wholeness from the world, and that's very, you know, or from others, which stops us from really being able to be with other people fully, because you need them to be a particular way. You can't be interested in who they actually are. Yeah. It's a great freedom to the other person also, because you're free to love them as they are and be engaged in your situation, you know. After all, it is your situation. It is your unique. It is your life. It is your prarabdha. So you can be engaged in it. But that's very hard to do if you think that, you know, you're trying to seek happiness out of it. Then you have to be this way or that way.
Mm-hmm. That would be an example. I have a question, and I think you just answered it. You mentioned that there are certain kinds of I guess dukkha that go away, the ones that are caused by ajnanam.
I could go in that way. I mean, the world is, there's a lot of suffering in the world. You know, even if you have knowledge, if I have a broken arm, knock on wood, it'll hurt. Right? So that kind of dukkha is there. If somebody who's close to me dies, there'll be emotional pain. But the way that all of those things are responded to is much different. Because all of those things are taking place, they're produce their own dukkha, just objectively speaking. You know, it's not my imagination that my mind is hurt. It's not my imagination that somebody dear to me has passed away. All these kind of things. You know, but those things are taking place in somebody who is free. It's a childhood habit.
You've been doing that for years.
Forever.
So they're just vrittis, basically.
Yeah, they're vrittis, but they're vrittis that are take place in the wholeness of my being.
Well, it's kind of like a double life, you know. There's this.
Well, it's the life of mitya is taking place in satyam, mm-hmm. You know, and the satyam never wavers or changes at all. You know, never. It's always exactly the same, no matter what experiences are taking place, you know.
I had a thought the other day. Oh my gosh, I've been penified.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. What happened to Penny?
Atma's been pennified.
I thought I said, oh my gosh, I've been pennified. I just sort
of. I like that. Yeah, that's nice.
Welcome.
So the things that, to get down to this, there are certain your responses to the ordinary dukkha of life, that's always there anyway, are different.
That they're quite different, because there's a self there that's not suffering. In other words, you can, just like what I was trying to do in the meditation, whatever thought is passing through, it can be an emotion, it can be anything. Any vritti that is passing through, any emotion that's passing through, is not changing my presence at all. And that's something to be noticed. Then, excuse me, I can sneeze. Once you really notice that, you never not notice it. You can have a dukkha vritti that is taking place through some sort of loss or whatever it is, but nothing happens to you. There's the sadness there of the vritti, but you are present as you are, always the same, as the self of that sadness, and that viveka is always there. Right? Now, for jnani, the mind on these emotions and whatnot that are generated by the environment, one thing that I think happens to the way the mind works is it doesn't build up on the emotions like why me type of thing, where you're building a big network around of thoughts around the emotion, and positive or negative, it's just simply there without a lot of build up, not a lot of the secondary process going on, and that means that's the writing on water, so to speak. But it's not to say that you don't have any emotions or that you're just a... That's not right either. That's not human.
Well, you can have a build-up. Say you do have a build-up, but at the same time the presence isn't in that.
That's true. And then when you have a build-up and it's causing you pain, you can bring your mind back and there's not very far to go because there's no distance. There's no distance between yourself and whatever the mind is doing. And so if it's building up and taking you on a ride... Mm-hmm. At some point, you may decide just to bring it home, you know? Swamiji's told this story. I don't know, it's somewhere in the tradition. I don't really know where it came from. It's about this sea captain who was out to sea in his ship, you know, with his mates and all. And he's... told, he receives a notice somehow that his wife had been killed. So somebody delivers to him that news, and he goes, what? And then he goes, so what? What? So what? And your daughter and children have been all killed also. What? So what? And I've lost all of your livestock. What? So what? He's a gnani. What the point of that story is, of course, Swamiji tells it quite a bit better, but the point of the story is like there can be that, what? You know? And then so what? It's true. Nothing happens, you know? Even though it's a great shock, it's not something that you would choose. But at the same time, nothing happens, you know?
Well, again, it goes back to, like, being a double life here, you know?
Well, you can say that, but there's not really a double life between satyam and mitya. Mm-hmm. Because you are the satyam. You never take your... It is yourself that is not changing. It is your being that is not changing. And so the mitya... is always changing, you know. It's always changing, but you're not. And so, Swamiji tells another story. I think he made this one up. He says, he says, you know, an Indian woman in her little hut has just, you know, lost her husband, and she's weeping and weeping, you know. And then he goes, and weeping, she's making her coffee. And weeping, she's doing the dishes. And weeping, she's, you know, cleaning the house. You know? In weeping, she's cooking the meal. He said, weeping, life goes on. You know, mm-hmm. Weeping, life goes on. Weeping, she goes on.
And that I would it also goes on when positive, you know, pleasurable.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same thing.
Same thing.
You know the ignorant, the avidya?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of primarily takes place in the buddhi, right?
Yeah, the avidya is really beginningless. See, even here, when we say what is like, when does ajnanam, when does ignorance begin? Like, say somebody walks in the room, this is an example. Say somebody walks in the room that you've never seen before. When does the ignorance of that person begin? When did it begin? You would say, it's beginningless. What began was the knowledge. The knowledge of the ignorance has a beginning, right? Oh, I never have met that person before. Now I know the person. But the ignorance has no beginning. And so for your buddhi, the ignorance of the self is beginningless. Right? But it has to be located in the buddhi, right? And it has to be removed in the buddhi also, in a sense.
So where's Vedanta locating the buddhi? Is that where is that buddhi?
The buddhi is in Ishvara. Right? The buddhi is in Ishvara. But from the standpoint of the buddhi, there's a jnanam, or from the standpoint of Maya, it's like being Ishvara is on the other side of Maya, in a sense. But you are within Maya. And that being within Maya causes the buddhi itself as a product of that Maya. And so that Maya is acting as a jnanam from the standpoint of the buddhi. And so that's why knowledge has to take place in that buddhi. The ignorance has to be removed from the ignorance of the self has to be removed from the buddhi. But the buddhi itself is a product of Maya, which acts as ajnanam from the buddhi, but from Ishvara it's just that creative capacity.
So, if that buddhi is everywhere...
Your buddhi isn't everywhere. Ishvara's buddhi is everywhere.
Yeah, but it seems like...
If we don't really call it a buddhi, but we call it the Maya Upadhi.
But I'm just kind of wondering, it's like, where is this buddhi exactly? I mean, where are we actually trying to... This idea of that there's nothing to be located, you know, in a certain
way. Only from the standpoint of the self. Right?
From a standpoint, from the relative self, or from the function of the Upadhi, then... You can find it, obviously. Then you can say, well, it's in the brain, or it's in your nervous system, or it's...
What is?
I'm just saying, where's the buddhi for Vedanta?
Well, the buddhi is subtle.
Yeah.
The buddhi is the sukshma sharira that identifies... Sukshma sharira identifies with the physical body. The karmendriya's organs of action identify with, you know...
Yeah.
The sukshma sharira takes on this physical body.
Right.
Isn't it like a sheath? Mind.
Well, sheath is a point of identification. No,
anyway,
I can't go there.
You know, the mind and the manas, that seems to be clear in terms of location because it's so tied into the sense organs and
well, what about the buddhi?
Yeah, and then the buddhi, it's like, yeah, it's a kind of, that's not so clear. That's like, just to limit that to the brain or something, it seems like reductionistic in a way.
It doesn't have to be just limited to the brain. To what degree, what are its functions that pervade the physical body? And the manas, what are its functions that pervade the physical body? How much does it work in the nervous system and all of that? I don't know.
So it pervades everything, really?
Well, the subtle body pervades everything. And to what degree all of these capacities pervade, you know. Say the subtle body pervades everything. And then from the standpoint of the subtle body being able to go like this. Say that's the karmendriya.
Mm-hmm.
Say the subtle body being able to use the sense organs.
Mm-hmm.
Then we break it down further than that, you know. Being parts of the sattva aspect of the five elements and the rajas aspect and all of that. So it's a big thing. I can't go there right now because I'm tired. Yeah. But they're good questions. It's just you need your time for it. Requires this kind of a systematic this and then this and then this and then this to make it clear. But we'll do it later.